My guest started playing classical and flamenco guitar at the age of 11, but his interest in rock and jazz soon led him to switch to electric guitar. He was a member of the Young Northside Big Band before studying at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. He co-founded and enjoyed stunning success with the band Dig, or Directions in Groove, and then moved to New York City and studied with guitarist Peter Bernstein. As a leader, he's released a number of critically acclaimed albums and is about to launch his new album, the trio album Undertones. Tim Rollinson, welcome back to Now's the Time.
Well, thanks very much, Frank. So it's great to be back.
Tim, I can't believe it's been 12 years since we last chatted on Now's the Time. That's a lot of water under the bridge. I realise that the first jazz record you bought was the German MPS Joe Pass recording Intercontinental, which I also found in my own record collection. But I suppose it's probably worthwhile us recapping on how you came to the guitar in the first place. I know you started playing the guitar, your father's classical acoustic guitar that he wasn't using.
That's exactly right. Yeah, well, it was after a trip to England with my brother, my mother and myself. My parents had emigrated from England, going to New Zealand and then coming to Sydney. But after a few years away, my mum was feeling a bit homesick. So the plan was that she'd take the kid over there, and if she wanted to stay in England, my dad would fly over, and that would be that. But she decided to come back here. But while we were away, it was a few months. Yeah, Dad bought an old sort of, I think it was like a Suzuki classical guitar and a book, how to play the classical guitar. I can picture the book, but I can't remember the name of it. And I would just sort of pick it up. And eventually, because nobody else in the family played an instrument, and of course we were just like, you know, the four of us living in Diwai, there was no kind of extended family. So, I went to the local guitar studio in Diwai and had some lessons, which kind of went for a while. And then a different guitarist came in, took over the business, this guy called Paul Pallister, who is still around. I mean, he sort of makes amps and things up near New South Wales, Queensland border, and plays, you know, guitar professionally as well. So he was kind of a little bit of the key for me. He showed me a few things that wasn't, you know, in the classical music vein.
But then you found some fertile ground in that Young Northside Big Band that produced such names as Andrew Gander and Dale Barlow, Chris Abrahams, Lloyd Swanton, and even James Morrison.
That's right. Yeah, well, I mean, that started in my high school, Manly. It was Manly Boys High School back then. I mean, I think it's called Manly Selective School now. And it was a guy called Carrie Bennett who still plays and plays drums and sings, and he lives up in Armidale. He's running a couple of gigs up there even to this day. In fact, I saw him at the Manly Jazz Festival just last week. He wanted to start up a big band of some description, but of course, this was sort of in the time when big bands weren't really sort of in schools particularly. So we just had like a, you know, I'd describe it as a ragtag bunch of kids with some couple of students from the girls' school, which was across the paddock, and Manly girls, and we had like sort of, you know, it was almost like to the point of kazoo, baritone, saxophone, and tuba kind of thing. It was just like all sorts of bits and pieces thrown together, and it, eventually Carrie sort of just felt like he didn't have enough knowledge, you know, as he was like a 16-year-old running a band full of, you know, 14-year-olds, and so he had been to Harbord Primary, and one of the teachers there was John Spate, who eventually, of course, started the Manly Jazz Festival. And he went to John and said, look, I've got this kind of band, we started it up, but we don't really know what to do and where to get arrangements for it. So John sort of got interested after he came and heard us and thought, oh, you know, this is kind of okay. So he let us rehearse at the primary school hall every Saturday morning, and the whole thing grew from there. And as people kind of, you know, came in and dropped out, and then John sort of canvassed the local area to find other players. He was always looking because if somebody dropped out, he wanted to find somebody better, you know, because the band was kind of developing. So yeah, we ended up with people like, you know, James Morrison, who lived up at Pittwater sort of area. John Morrison was there for a while. Andrew Gander, he just came along as a 14-year-old one day and auditioned. And of course, it was like, wow, you know, this guy is amazing. And so on and so on. You know, we had lots of really good players. So, you know, some of them stuck around and some of them kind of went off and did other things.
But of course, you had an extensive career if we fast forward even prior to the dig years. But if we do fast forward to the dig years, as I mentioned, it was a stunning period for you and the guys out of Directions in Groove. There must have been many, many, many highlights. But can you name, say just one major highlight that stands out from all the rest from Dig?
Well, you're really putting me on the spot there. I mean, it was a 10-year period, really, and it was fairly intense. So lots of things happened. I mean, if I was to put it down to one, I mean, I guess it was the one that springs to mind, I think, is after we recorded our first album, which is called Deeper. And I was driving, I can't remember where I was, but I was driving through along Pittwater Road. And I wasn't living in that area at the time. Of course, I had grown up there, but I must have been, I was traveling from one place to another, heading back to the city. And I remember turning on the radio, which is sort of Triple J, and hearing one of our tracks. I thought, oh, well, that's nice. You know, like Triple J's playing it, though. That's good. And then as I drove, like I heard another track, and then I heard a third track in the space of an hour. And I thought to myself, wow. I think this really means something. So that was exciting, you know. But you know, you could also add going to like the Montreux Jazz Festival and playing on the Miles Davis stage, and you know, traveling overseas to various places. It's kind of hard to put it down to one, but I remember being quite excited by that sort of Triple J airplay, because back in the early 90s, I think it meant a lot, you know, to get played three or four times within the space of an hour on a national radio show like that, which a lot of people obviously listen to.
We know Rick Robertson these days lives offshore, literally, I think, Norfolk Island.
Onshore on Norfolk. But yes, he's
but you recently
fled Australia.
Reunited for a rare performance, I think, didn't you? Is that right?
We did. We got back together, say, it's about 6 weeks ago, I suppose, now. We were doing support for the band that you probably have heard of. They were quite big back in the day. The Brand New Heavies, the English band, and we did two supports for them. Originally, it was going to be more, and the whole idea came about pre-COVID. So at first, we were going to do about six capital cities around Australia, and then it got cancelled, and then it was on again, and then it got cancelled again, and then eventually the promoter couldn't really afford to, you know, fly us around the country. So we did Sydney at the Enmore, and we did The Rule, Anita's Theatre, mm-hmm. which is an amazing little venue just south of Sydney.
Do you think this is something you might be able to lure Rick back from a little bit more often to do?
It is possible. I mean, whether or not, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? It's like, it's something's nice in small doses, but then if you try to kind of recapture something, it can go horribly wrong. But we'll see. I mean, there are no plans, so I know that sounds like a politician speaking, but there's seriously no plans. The promoter who ran the gig, the Brand New Heavies, he sort of said, well, would you guys be interested in doing something, you know, maybe next year? So I guess, yeah, there is a potential, but it's sort of, you know, nothing's definitely on the cards at the moment.
Now, the brand new album of the Tim Rollinson Trio, Undertones, what's distinctive about this album is that whilst it follows the typical guitar organ trio format that was very popular in the 1960s, artists that come to mind like Grant Green, Kenny Burrell, Wes Montgomery, which I think you tipped the hat a little on the album as well with Wes Tern. All the music on this album of yours is originally written, so they're all original compositions, which is quite significant. But composing has always been a craft that you've compelled to do.
Well, definitely, yeah. I mean, there has been times when I sort of tossed up playing the guitar or like writing music. At one point, I wanted to write for film, and it was funny because every time I thought seriously about that, something has come along in the playing department that has kind of basically just totally wiped that out. I mean, one of the times I started writing for some short films like just before Dig started, and then of course suddenly like Dig just took up my, you know, okay, 10 years later suddenly. Yeah, so I mean, I'm very interested in writing, and I do write quite a lot, but I'm not very disciplined as a writer. Like I write sort of in spurts. Like sometimes I'll sit down and there'll be lots of ideas, and I'll kind of get out a recording device. You know, these days, of course, it's like the phone, and just put stuff down, and then I'll come back to it later and sort of polish it, and then I won't really write for you know, possibly months. So thank goodness for recording, because the way that I do write, it's kind of just really off the cuff, I'll record it, then I might only come back to it a few months later and go, oh, okay, now that one sounds really good. I think I can work on that one. So yeah, so I put the basic ideas down, and then I just let it sort of sit for a while, and then when I come back, the ones that really grab me are the ones that I work on.
Tim, your trio members on organ, Clayton Doley, one of the most in-demand organ players in Australia. What were you looking for in his playing to your sound?
Well, you know what? I mean, really, again, it wasn't something that I planned. I suddenly got a call from Clayton one day. I mean, we'd met years ago, just around and about, and we knew each other, but hadn't really played very much. And suddenly there was a band playing at the Hollywood Hotel in Surry Hills with Clayton, James Ryan and Andrew Dickerson. And and I think Carl Dewhurst was playing guitar, and they needed somebody to fill in one night. So just out of the blue, Clayton called me. And then I kept coming back, because I think Carl was just kept on getting busy. So in the end, I was just offered the gig. And then as well as that, then Clayton got me to do a couple of gigs with his sort of side project, that which he calls the Flashing Dashbacks.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of like a bit of a Jimmy Smith sort of organ type thing, and a few originals and a few old, kind of blues numbers. So I was kind of, suddenly I was playing quite a lot with Clayton, and I was just really, really enjoying it. And then, you know, we also started to do some gigs with Jamie on drums, because Jamie's basically Clayton's drummer in the Bayou Billabong, which is Clayton's big personal project, as well, of course, as playing with, you know, Jimmy Barnes and Richard Clapton and Mahalia Barnes and Ellie Mae Barnes and, you know, all sorts of people. I mean, he, as you say, is very much in demand because he's such a great player. And anyway, so I thought, I was so lucky to play with him. I just thought, this just seems like a really great time to dust off some of those pieces that I've got, which I always thought would be great for an organ trio. And so I wrote some new stuff, and I dusted off a couple of older ones and just took those two guys into the studio. And so really it just sort of happened sort of bit by bit. Just, it was like a steady wave when I sort of thought, well, you know, I'm either going to get dumped or I'll jump on the surfboard and ride it, which is kind of what happened. I just decided to grab the opportunity.
Back in 2013, Pat Metheny, I think he just won the Downbeat Hall of Fame Award. He sort of admits at that particular time that he has unreachable musical targets. What would you love to achieve musically that you think, that might be out of reach?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, really, if you cast your mind to what might be out of reach, I guess there's many, many things that could be out of reach. I'm not sure if I have that sort of lofty ambition in the fact, I mean, I am just a person who just loves playing music for a living. I mean, I can't get over how lucky I am and have been. I really enjoy sort of hanging out with people, playing music, and, you know, in a way that's enough. I mean, if I had like that sort of incredible facility and technique and sort of background that somebody like Pat Metheny had, then I guess my ambitions might be a little higher, because, you know, he could probably, almost anything he could imagine, you know, in my mind, he could probably play it. Maybe in his own mind, he might not live up to what he's thinking. But I guess from an outsider's point of view, when you listen to somebody like him play, it's like, you know, the technique is impeccable. But as I say, I think I'm just somebody who just like doing what I'm doing and always just trying to improve and to get better. And but as well as that, like, I think that sort of satisfaction can strike you at any time. I mean, there have been the odd night or even the odd song, the odd improvisation solo, guitar solo or whatever, where I've just gone, you know, I've just felt, I'm just so like in the zone tonight, you know, like, and that really, I think that's part of why we all do it. Like that feeling when you're actually just, again, it's like riding a wave, you know, it's like you're either kind of controlling, you know, what's going on, but it's sort of easy, but you know that you've led up to this point by working hard, but it's kind of easy in the moment, it's easy. So for me, it's just a series of those moments, like to try to achieve that kind of experience more, because I think that means, I'm sure that's when it sounds the best for the audience too. I mean, I'd feel like, well, what's the use of music if it doesn't feel good to you and feel good to the audience, if you know what I'm saying? It's sort of like, surely it's something that's transferable.
We've certainly seen some emerging changes in the jazz scene in terms of post-COVID. What are you seeing?
Well, My personal experience is different to many in that I have never had such a busy year playing jazz as I have this year, which I know is not everyone's experience, but I know it's quite a few people's experience. And, you know, and obviously some, maybe it's different for them in a, or maybe they were having a great time before COVID when I wasn't working quite as much. So, you know, it comes and goes, I think, with music. I mean, I'm not always busy, but I have been this year, and, you know, I'm thanking, you know, the stars have aligned, and that's great. And again, just having that opportunity to play jazz three or four times a week is just incredible. I feel myself improving, you know, week by week. You know, that kind of relates back to your last question. It's like, it's, I think the more that you can do it, the better you get. And obviously, like, if you're, you know, an international star, like some of the guitarists you mentioned, I mean, I guess they just get to play all the time. And no wonder that, you know, I mean, they're great to start with, but of course, just that constant doing it, it means that you get to learn the songs better. You know, you have more freedom. You have your ideas flow faster, fingers flowing faster. So it's all kind of related. But I think if there's one overriding thing about COVID, it's like, it seems to me that a lot of people have taken the opportunity to maybe just adjust their lifestyle a little bit. I mean, I've kind of read, you know, online news articles that many people are just leaving their job and going for something sort of maybe just more suitable, less stressful perhaps. So I think in music, the music field is similar in a way. I think a lot of people are just going, well, you know what, if I'm going to play music, I might as well make it creative music. I might as well be enjoying what I'm doing. Maybe less of that wedding band stuff, or maybe less, you know, maybe less reading in the pit. The orchestra pit, maybe I should, you know, I mean, I can't really speak for other people, but I'm kind of guessing that feeling is kind of spread throughout society a little. I think people are going, well, you know, like, I've just sort of, what's life, you know, I guess you've had time to think, what's life all about, you know, and how can I adjust things? I've had a break, and my mind is clear now. It's not like I'm doing the same thing every day, ad infinitum. Like, how can I change? How can I improve things? I mean, for me, like, recording this album was a result of the lockdown, because I had time to think it through, time to compose.
And that's evident on the album. It's a fine album. I was lucky enough to catch you recently at the Manly Jazz Festival. You just mentioned that gig, a performance there with the actual trio, Clayton Doley, organ, Jamie Cameron on the drums. It was fabulous. What are your thoughts on the Northern Beaches Council move to shrink the festival back from 3 days to two and three main stages back to two? I mean, you've played Manly many times through the years.
Well, you know what? I mean, if I could swear on live radio, I would. Because to me, it's like the classic old saying, but if it ain't, you know, if it ain't broke, don't try to fix it. I mean, the story that I've heard is that the council was thinking, like, well, if we, you know, if we move it onto a, you know, like the long weekend, you get plenty of people coming down to Manly anyway. So a bit, small businesses don't really need the festival to be on that weekend. So if we put it on a different weekend, which in this case they made it the weekend before, then maybe we'll get lots of people on the weekend before and we'll get lots of people on the long weekend. Now, I can't see the logic in that, because to me it just breaks the continuity. And also, of course, it takes it from 3 days to 2 days. So, I mean, less people are playing. You know, people, I'm not sure exactly when they made the switch, but I mean, when you've got a festival that's been running for, how long is it? Is it
45 years.
It's 45 years, yeah. You know, people put that weekend in their diary, like even overseas musicians, American musicians, European musicians, English musicians. They go, Manly Festival's on that weekend, I'm keeping that weekend free, you know. But then change it. It's sort of like, well, maybe there's another festival in, you know, New York that weekend, or that's, people think, well, I'll do the New York one because that's local to me, or there's one in Berlin, or, you know, like, I mean, you establish something over 45 years that people obviously take notice of, and everybody knows it's, you know, anybody interested in jazz and music in general in Sydney knows that it's that weekend, or it was that weekend, and now it's not. So, well, it's safe to say that I'm not a huge fan of moving it. Mm. And I'd love to know if there's, like, any kind of Machiavellian sort of things at work. Because it seems to me, like, why would... Is it as simple as them just moving it for, like, the reasons they've given? I mean, it doesn't seem that would be enough of a reason to me.
It's certainly contentious, and I think there is going to be lots more discussed around the decision. But we'll leave that for another occasion. Once again, from your pen, further down the road, briefly tell us a little bit about this one.
Okay. If you're out there listening, you have been listening to this interview, then it relates very much so. When I was back in the Northside Big Band, we recorded an album called Quiet Breaker. And on that album was a track called Down the Road. And John Spate, who was the band leader at that time, he kind of featured me on that track. And it's like a 15-year-old me playing a guitar solo. And then you cut to now, which is many years later, I wrote this tune which kind of reminded me of that song. So I kind of, as like a bookend, I called it Further Down the Road as opposed to Down the Road. And so I guess, you could almost dig out that other track and put them side by side and see if there's been any progression. I hope there has been. Yeah, and it was dedicated to John Spate because of that. John Spate was like in my sort of teenage years, for 3 or 4 years there, he was very much a mentor to me and to many others. And he introduced me to Kenny Burrell, Jim Hall, and many other sort of musicians. I used to occasionally go around to his place and sort of he'd show me a few chords on the piano and we'd listen to some music and it was a nice sort of family atmosphere. Of course, Andrew Spate was really young then and Caroline and Emma were both. And Caroline, of course, runs the Manly Jazz Festival now. So, yeah, so that's the kind of backstory behind that song.
Tim Rawlinson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, Frank. It was much appreciated.